Okay, well, thank you for being here. It's nice to make it to downtown. It's kind of like a foreign country for me. And apart from the geographical dissonance, you know, the other thing that makes me very terrified is, like, you know, I'm facing a lecture hall full of public health people. I don't know what that is. You know, because I'm a critical race theorist. My training is in anthropology. And you know, I teach uptown, so I don't know what you guys do over here. But in fear for my own reputation and faux pas, you know, I decided I would contact a good friend of mine who I've known since, you know, my undergraduate days, and we were politically active together at the Black Cultural Center at Swarthmore College in Pennsylvania. But she now, you know, is a researcher on violence, and she works with the CDC, the National Center for Injury and Prevention Control. And my own areas of expertise and the research that I have done around social justice, racial justice work, you know, tends to be along the lines of racial violence and racialized state violence, you know, broadly put, which would include questions of police abuse and police brutality. So I was having this conversation with her. I was like, okay, I'm going to speak to these public health types, like people from your part of the world. Like, and here are some of my ideas. This is what I'm thinking, especially in the light of events that have been happening almost daily now with regards to police killing of black people in the United States. You know, my question to her was like, so why is this not a public health problem? Why is it not framed as a public health issue? It's not the area that I come from. And so, you know, we have this conversation that I will share with you. So, and she says, you cannot cite me as a CDC, you know, personnel. This is a personal conversation between, because she signed lots of papers, she said. So this is not from the CDC. This is me talking to my undergraduate friend who happens to work at the CDC. But in a sense, you know, we have to think about the medical model, right, and the question of values that are part of the public health framework. And in Shakila's view, you know, when you look at things that define the public health framework, which is questions of morbidity, rates, infection, how many people in a population are infected, what's the leading cause of death, you will find that police violence then will not register in the radar very highly, right? It becomes a devalued public health issue because it doesn't quite muster the statistics. You also can't call it a public health crisis if it smacks of being politically rooted, like police violence, anti-black police violence can be seen as a political issue, and the CDC is incredibly constrained from delivering any kind of pronouncements that can be read as being political. So these are some of the ideas that she shared with me in terms of, like, what would be the barriers to thinking about it. But she also talked about another very key factor, that if you actually look at leading causes of deaths for the populations that are affected by police violence, black males, it's actually not police violence. Does anyone know what it is? Where the leading cause of death for black males between 15 to 34? Homicide, right? Over 50%. Now, that's a significant morbidity rate, 50%, which does not register at all within the public health framework. That's scandalous, right? It's absolutely scandalous. And it brings us back to thinking about, and this is what critical race theorists do, thinking about the very institutional and structural rules that are themselves racialized, right, in order to produce these kinds of aporias or gaps within the public health framework. And critical race theorists don't take prisoners. We don't care what those rules are. We are guided by the outcome. And we are going to fight the aporia until the outcomes become legible within the frameworks that can actually do something about these issues. And in my conversation with Shakila, I also, you know, was enlightened by the fact that, you know, if we were to look at the strengths of public health as a framework, how could they actually be very apropos to the situation? Well, of all the public policy tools that we have, criminal justice, foreign policy, war, et cetera, public health actually works on a prevention and intervention basis, that it actually has purchase in the situation. It could have purchase in the situation, but it does not, right? When I explain to my students, you know, the critical race theory understanding of what we question, that we do not accept the rules and the frameworks and the structures as given, but we are in the active process of challenging those if they are barriers to racial justice, you know, I kind of bring up the idea, okay, in a democratic polity or along democratic principles, what are some of the key ideals? What are some of the key ideals in a democratic polity? Anyone wants to shoot out a couple of things? Equality, right? Economics, I heard you. Okay, equality, right? So rules shouldn't be structured to reproduce inequality. They should be structured to produce equality, right? Then I tell them, well, okay, if that's the case, is the NFL unconstitutional? Who says the rules have to be that only men play football? But once we have set those rules, then what is left for women to do? Get your pom-poms. Okay, now we say we are going to intervene in this, but the rules stay intact. Okay, you tell me. How do you then deal with that situation? Well, critical race theorists like to step back and try to examine where the chessboard has already been set up, which might be incredibly flawed and have basically racializations going on that need to be critiqued and exposed. So with the benefit of that conversation, you know, I decided to think about the idea of declaring a crisis or making something register as a crisis within the framework of public health. And, you know, if you go to the WHO website, you know, they use a pretty straightforward dictionary definition of what a crisis is, a situation that's perceived as difficult. Its greatest value is that it implies the impossibility of an insidious process that cannot be defined in time and that even spatially can recognize different layers, levels of intensity. Its greatest value is that it implies the possibility, a crisis may not be evident and it demands analysis to be recognized. That stood out for me, right? Because what it's saying is that you cannot actually have a positivistic collection or mapping of a phenomena until you begin to conceptualize its existence and its evidence, right? You cannot just say that it's a illegible or statistically insignificant phenomena prior to the conceptualization of that phenomena. Does that make sense? Right? So let's think about how police violence can be conceptualized, made to conceptualize so that it'll begin to register in a public health framework. What would make a phenomena that killed 732 people so far this year into a public health crisis? Yeah. All right. So the barrier is because it doesn't fall into the epidemic definition, right? You know, you need something like a Zika virus. Zika virus, the morbidity so far has been what? Two people, I think. One in Puerto Rico, if you count it as part of the United States, and one in Utah. And then it's got about 200,000 infections. Okay, something like that, which is now a profound urgency for the CDC, right? You know, something with a morbidity rate of that much, but a rate of infection per population that seems to be high can register. So 732 people killed by the police, how do you make that register within this particular conceptualization? It's doomed to failure, right? Are you going to accept that? Okay, so let's think. Yeah. So you're talking about a social value. You're interjecting a social value into the discourse because public health, right, explicitly understands its remit as being able to make interventions at multiple levels, individual, relational, community, so on and so forth, that this actually falls within that category. It's actually something preventable. It's not God-given, right? It's not a natural disaster, right? This is actually something that is preventable. Yep, we are the leading nation. We are the best in everything. We're the best in this, too. We are the leading nation among peer industrial countries for police violence and police killing. you know, that, that there is, there are various ways in which if you interject the question of the prevention remit of public health and the social value discussion into public health, that we can actually begin to make this signify in various ways. Here's one line of thinking that I thought would also perhaps make for an argument that we can test and advance. Well, if you look at the distribution, since Ferguson, you all know what Ferguson is, right? Since Ferguson killing a Michael Brown, there have been a further 2,195 deaths by the police. That's at a space of what? 2 years. Okay? But look at the distribution of this. It's pretty much national, right? And if it's not only distributive in such a pervasive and all-comprehensive manner, what is the collateral damage of these kinds of traumatic incidences within these communities that are scattered across the country? What would be the collateral damage in public health terms of having the frequency and pervasiveness of anti-black policing saturate the national geography? And I turn you to the work of Dr. David Williams, right, who is a public health scholar, sociologist, and historian at Harvard, who came out with this measure called the heightened vigilance scale, right? I urge you to check out his work and to also think about the ways in which the collateral damages of anti-black policing does actually register on a physiological level and can be measured, and obviously has negative impacts on health. We do not have a ready-made database by which to go to be able to amass these kinds of statistics to make it a case within the public health level, but I think we have very strong arguments that we need to begin to have these kinds of targeted studies and targeted research being carried out in order for us to be able to fully appreciate what anti-black policing is doing within black communities, right? I think, you know, being an anthropologist, one of the things that we do is that, you know, we engage in participant observation research, where we actually go into communities, hang out with them, and begin to then, rather than starting with an a priori set of variables, you actually begin to figure out what the variables are when you're actually in the field. So it seems to me that this is an area where using those kinds of methodologies would be incredibly important. Now, black communities themselves are going to be the biggest repository of knowledge concerning the impact of anti-black policing, whether it's on a physiological mental health level, whether it's on a intergenerational level affecting children's well-being and mental health, capacity to learn, capacity to thrive, et cetera, et cetera. These are all questions that could be researched and should be researched, right? So we have a basis to make those kinds of interventions. Oftentimes, you know, I'm confronted with the situation in critical race theory where a lot of people have a very kind of outdated notion of what racism is. A lot of my students, when they come into class, you know, have this kind of formulaic understanding of racism. I bet you've heard of it, equals to power plus privilege, okay? And critical race theory, in many ways, is incredibly antagonistic towards this idea and definition of racism that has become a doxa or, you know, hegemonic within the field. An alternative definition through the work of Ruthie Gilmore defines racism as a fatal coupling of power and difference that results in premature death. There's a lot of history behind how we got to this point, which I can't get into right now, but going away from the idea that racism is an individual, irrational deviation or aberration into the notion that we have systemic occurrences that result in the outcomes of premature death, right? And it is that we have systemic articulations of power that couple with racial and ethnic difference, religious difference even, result and produce premature death. So when we look at anti-black policing, we look at anti-black policing as only one node in a very broad continuum of racism, right? If you look at life chances statistics, if you look at health disparities, if you look at incarceration statistics, if you look at educational statistics, on the flip side, if you look at how many people who are black who are teaching at Tulane, does anyone know? 3.5%, okay? If you look at the professions, sociology, anthropology, public health, et cetera, what is the inclusivity of people from racial and ethnic minority backgrounds within the power structures that get to shape those disciplines and those fields of knowledge? You can look at it both ways. You can look at it at the adverse level, and you can look at it at the inclusive level. And in both ways, you begin to get a sense that there's something bigger than just individual level psychological aberrations that are taken on. It's not even a question of hate. It's not even a question of hate, right? Hate is a derivation of an irrational or erroneous prejudicial thinking that doesn't have any substance to it. But it's more difficult for us to think about racism in the ways Gilmore thinks about it if we understand it as a shaping force in society that actually structures and articulates institutions and practices both in the state level as well as in civil society, in universities, so on and so forth. So if you have this broader structural understanding of racism, then you begin to see that anti-black violence, anti-black policing, is structured very much within a broader failure of American democracy, right? A failure of American democracy that constitutes African Americans, black people, as being an outside. That means what happens to them on a corporeal level, if they die, it does not register within the parameters of liberal juridical review in the United States. Why? What do I mean by this? Let's take policing. You cannot convict a police officer for killing somebody. Why is that? The Supreme Court upholds it again and again. It even strikes out using Fifth Amendment arguments. It even strikes down the necessity of having due process before they kill you. The Supreme Court has argued repeatedly it does not require the police officer to pursue due process in order to kill you. Okay? Why is this? Think back to the NFL rules again, okay? That's the chessboard, right? The chessboard is, according to the prevailing case law, which is Graham versus Connor, it came out in 1989, that what you need to do to be able to convict a police officer is to prove two things in conjunction. One is, as this colleague of ours says, you will have to prove that the police officer willfully intended to break the law governing his or her powers. You have to prove it. You can't say he or she did it. You have to prove that there was intent to break the law, right? So that means, you know, the police officer decided that morning, I'm going to go kill a black person today, and you have to prove that in a court of law to say that person was intending to carry out that action, in conjunction with proving that the perception of the police officer of a threat to him or herself or to the public was erroneous, it was unreasonable. Meaning, not that it was wrong. Michael Brown didn't have a gun. Terrence Crutcher was in a stalled car. So obviously they did not pose threats. They were wrong. It doesn't matter. Under the rules, all you have to do, or what you have to do to prove that this was a crime, was to demonstrate in a court of law that the police officer's perception of the threat that he or she was encountering was wrong. And if the perception was reasonable, not correct or incorrect, reasonable, if a big black guy started waving his arms and the police officer says, I felt threatened, all the court has to do is say, was that reasonable? And they go, yeah, it was reasonable. The perception was reasonable. So to convict a police officer, you have to prove both of these things in conjunction. Otherwise, you have nothing, which means, what will happen tomorrow? There's going to be another one, and there's going to be another one, and there's going to be another one. Now, these are liberal juridical rules. Do you accept them? The structural impossibility of acquiring liberal justice within the U.S. legal framework puts African Americans on a constitutive outside in terms of any kind of redress that they can actually make vis-a-vis policing violence. And that itself, I would argue, constitutes an incredible disadvantage and an incredible collateral damage that can have far-reaching health consequences. Which means to say, let's look at another example that's also very common. If you are raped, there's just no redress in the criminal justice system. And now go take care of your mental and physical health in that context, on that chessboard. Now structure your heightened vigilance to adjust for those rules. So, you know, if a Stanford swimmer does something and the university says fine, and the court system says okay, 3 months, suspended sentence, you have to adjust your safety, health, according to those power dynamics that are currently the law of the land. So this is a concept, you know, I'll throw it out there. I mentioned to Naomi, you know, if you guys want to read something I wrote, it's a particular article. You know, what I call this is routine anti-racist failure within the justice system, right? Within the liberal juridical system. And for me, you know, of course, these are questions of social and racial justice. But in the work that I did, which was based in another liberal democratic system, but comparatively, I feel it holds, a liberal juridical process that purports to stand over and adjudicate illiberal crimes or discriminatory violence is itself a race-making and racism-embedded site. As a result, racial, religious, and ethnic minorities who encounter white violence from races or from the state, like the police, tend towards routine failure in their attempts to obtain racial justice. And what I mean over here is that there's a certain kind of traumatic experience, I would argue, when you are not only facing the first act of the actual violence itself, but when you actually go to the systems of society, right? And, you know, when we think of systems, there are family systems, there's community systems, there's legal systems. When you go to the systemic level in order to acquire justice, you will not encounter justice, but what you will encounter is another racializing process in the adjudication of what was done to you. That's my claim. And this is actually what I found out when I was working on police abuse cases, trying to take cases to court. I mainly failed. And so what I had to theorize was the failure.